Good morning to everyone. We'll be starting with Matt's momentarily. Today's topic will be human aggression, working from Gemara in Sanhedrin 58b, towards the bottom. And we'll just start momentarily. Email last night, but I saw the email back to your wife that it didn't seem to have any links or images on it. It said it looks like a new format.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I saw your email and I don't have an explanation for it.
Well, send one to yourself just so you can see. Maybe that would help. But I guess you're using a new format.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It looks like you're using a new format, right? For the announcement, you're using a new format of email?
Doesn't appear to be to me. From my end of it, it looks the same.
Uh-huh. It looked different from my end.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll just respond this way, if that's what happens in the next time. And just as a heads up for next week, Jack Saunders was working on an area. By the way, how's the sound today, okay?
Good, but you're a little light.
A little light, okay. I'll try to get closer to the mic. There's a piece of Gemara right in the beginning of Avodah Zarah, Talmud Avodah Zarah, and it's basically from the beginning through 3b, so if you want to look through that during the week. Interesting about one of the concepts there is it seems to be saying that the Noahides have no commands anymore. If you just read it, one section of it, it seems to imply that. So he was curious to know what's going on. There happens to be a lot going on in those few pages. So, go through it and pretty much you could start from the beginning, right at the beginning of the tractate. I'm just wondering in terms of, actually no, you probably couldn't do that because that's talking about the Jewish law over there. I'll try to look for where, I think it starts at the bottom of 2A. All the tractates in the Talmud start from page 2. I remember once hearing when I was a kid, so you should never feel like, you did everything. Because if you started from page 1 and then you went to the end, now you did all the pages. If you start from page 2, so inherently you're missing a page, and you can never have that feeling that you learned all of Torah. So I'm not sure if that's the reason or, but I remember that stuck in my head since I was a child. But you take a look where it starts, and God says to all the nations, let whoever learned Torah come and receive the reward. And it says that all the nations were clamoring in a big confusion to claim their reward. So that's where it starts. And I guess you can go there through about like 3A, 3B, somewhere around there. Because there it's all just, you know, elucidating the whole story. Yes, it's going through the whole story. All right? Okay. For today, however, we're going to take up about human aggression, which is in Sanhedrin 58b. And it's a small piece, and we'll see what we can get from it. So it states, it's a statement of Reish Lakish. And Reish Lakish says, whoever lifts his hand against his friend, even though he doesn't hit him, he is called wicked person. As it states, that Moses said to, he saw Dathan and Abiram, the infamous duo, and he saw one was raising the hand to the other. So he says to them, why are you about to hit your friend? So the Talmud says, it doesn't say why did you already hit him, but it says that Moses said to them, why are you about? Why do you hit your friend? So even though he did not hit him yet, so Moses calls him a wicked person. All right? Simple enough. Ze'iri says, in the name of Rabbi Hanina, he is called a sinner, as it states. And this is now a ridicule of the sons of Eli. Eli was a priest in the temple, and he had two wicked sons that would forcibly take their portions. You know, they were the Levites were entitled to portions of meat from the people. And they would forcibly take it, I think before the time they were supposed to. And it says that one of the servants of these two wicked sons would say to the people, if you do not give me now, so then I will take it by force. And it's written afterwards, the next verse says that the sin of these two sons of Eli was great. So you see this talking about the sins, that the fact that they raised their hands, they forcibly wanted to take, even though they were entitled to it, but they did it in a manner which was using force, again, raising their hand. But here, this rabbi says that this person is called a sinner. First rabbi, Reish Lakish, says that he's a wicked person if he lifts his hand, even before hitting. Okay. And he says, but Rabbi Hanina seems to be saying on the same case, where they didn't even follow through with the force yet, but just the threat itself, again. He says you're called a sinner, not just a wicked person. And he bases that on verses. A third view is that of Rabbi Huna, who says that such a person should have his hand cut off. And it seems to be that there was a case that Rashi brings down that there was a person who typically did this. He was very much using his hands, so Rabbi Huna had his hand cut off because he used it too much to fight against people. Alright, and he says, this is based on the verse, the hand of the, those hands that are high, that are lifted, should be broken. Alright, so Reb Huna cuts Yada. So Reb Huna cut his hand off. Rabbi Elezer, the fourth and last view in this Gemara, says, there is no remedy except a grave for a person like this, as it states. A man of the arm, meaning a man who abuses his physical strength, lo haaretz, to him is the land. Okay, so that's really it. That's really the section over here. So we want to understand, if we can, these four different views. And they're not in conflict. The first view is saying that since Moses called the person wicked before he even hit the person, so you see that a person's wicked even without striking. And Ze'iri says he's called a sinner. So that's talking about how do we refer to the person? What is the person's violation. So we can discuss it, see if there's a conflict, or if just one is talking about a different aspect, so there's really no argument. And then we have Rav Huna, who says that you have to, that you cut his hand off, and Rabbi Elazar, who says there's no remedy until he dies. So death is the only remedy. Okay. That's all I have to say.
Great.
So have a good week, and I'll see you next week. You've got as much information as I have now. Is there anything you want me to repeat? I can repeat one more time if you want.
So our task here is to try to reconcile the four views?
Well, no. Why don't you just try to approach it anyway? I'm not saying what has to be done. Like I was saying, I don't even know if they're in the they're in conflict. But we have four statements in connection with, you know, an aggressive person, human aggression, and this this little piece of Talmud gives us insight. And so what we want to try to do is to draw out from it what we can. What do we feel the intended lessons are in terms of how they presented this in the Talmud and what was, you know, covered on this piece?
So does it make sense for us to try to define exactly what human aggression is in the context of this section?
Yes. Like, for example, the first one is called wicked. So that would be my first step as well. How do you define a wicked person from a sinner?
Well, okay, in Reish Lakish's explanation, he's saying that, if I'm understanding it right, it's not that you struck the person, it's that you were either planning to or thinking about striking the person.
Right.
That would seem that then one is being, punished is the right word, but at least judged or declared to be wicked solely on the basis of their thoughts.
Well, no, he did lift his hand. He had to lift his hand.
Oh, okay. So there is a physical action here.
Yeah.
Not like he's just thinking about, I'd like to punch the guy out.
Nope. Moses saw him lift his hand against his friend, and before he even hit him, he called them wicked.
What's the difference between a wicked and a sinner? It seems like a sinner is one who sins, one who has committed a transgression.
Okay, he did something against the Torah system.
So
that would be the case with the sons of Eli, where they, even before they took it, though, they threatened it, though. The Talmud here doesn't differentiate the case. They're saying the same case that you're calling a wicked person in the scenario between Moses and Dathan and Aviram. So Zairi comes in and says, no, that's called a sinner, and he proves it, meaning he says that very case you called a sinner, even though you didn't hit the person yet. And he just proves it from another case which is similar. He's saying the case of Eli's two wicked sons, the Torah calls them sinners. So it has to be a parallel case. Otherwise, you can't argue with him on what the term is. You have to be talking about the same case in order to say this rabbi says it's called a wicked person, and this rabbi says, no, he's called a sinner.
Okay, but then I guess we could say those terms are not mutually exclusive. I mean, one can be a sinner and also be wicked.
Yes, exactly. It could be that a sinner is a step more. He's wicked and he's also a sinner.
Well, wicked seems like it would have to do more with the internal person, and sinner has more to do with the fact that they did certain actions which puts them in a classification of one who sinned.
Right. And I would say also in terms of sin, there's one more thing that sin has over wicked. What would you say that is?
Well, could a person be wicked and not sin?
That's a good question.
That brings us back to what's the definition of wicked?
Yep.
So, can we equate wicked with evil?
Yeah, you can say that's true, that wicked and evil are parallels.
So if that's the case, my recollection from Rabbi Moskowitz is that Sajigan defines evil as ignorance.
I mean, all evil comes from ignorance. You can't be evil unless you're ignorant of something.
Okay. So then could we say that a wicked person is one who is ignorant? So that has to do with kind of his state of knowledge and wisdom. Whereas a sinner is one who actually carries out a transgression.
Okay, the transgression means... Oh. Right, so that's another step, right? I mean, to say when you sin... It would seem to be you're in a violation now with God. Maybe you could say that.
Right.
Because sin means you're going against something which is God's will for man, right?
Right.
Maybe with wicked, the person hasn't reached that. Like you had mentioned, internal.
Right, because I could... in the case Reish Lakish cited here... So I have raised my hand, I haven't committed the full act yet, but the sheer fact that I'm sort of on my way, and I'm beginning that act, indicates that I have a lack of understanding about the reality of the situation. I mean, I'm ignorant of something here. Because if I had full and complete knowledge of reality, I wouldn't hit my fellow.
Right.
So could we define a wicked person as one lacking, if I say lacking in understanding, though, then there's no difference between the wicked and the fool.
Yeah, just bringing out the case, I don't know if this will help us, but it says by the people of Sodom... The verse says in Genesis 18:20 that God said the cry of Sodom and Amorah is exceedingly great and their sin is heavy. It's very heavy. Their sin is heavy. So calls them sinners. But it doesn't say Rishayim. And we know that they had a very thwarted system of justice that was just for their own self gain.
Right.
So you said before, you were talking right, you were saying that the wicked person, it's internal.
Right.
So if we elaborate on what you started with, is that even though the person did not hit another person yet, but look what happened. His sense of making right is how. He's in an argument, and it resorts to brute force, to aggression.
Right.
Why? Because evidently his intellectual arguments are not too compelling. And therefore, he's intolerant of being wrong. So that's the saying, might makes right. People have a view that they yell loud enough, they hit. And this is how we resolve the conflict. This is how we demonstrate who's right, who's got the biggest bomb. That's where it ultimately ends.
Yeah.
So wicked would mean where the way you operate is completely bent on there's an inability for you to function in terms of truth. You have to be right. Rabbi Chaim once explained, he said, the wicked person is somebody who seeks to conform reality to his will. And the righteous person is the opposite. The righteous person conforms his will to reality. Right? The wicked person, he wants to twist reality to make it form to his will. So he creates idols. He's intolerant. All right, everything has to be with the way his subjective worldview is, and he has to force everything into that. And if it goes against him, he fights it tooth and nail. He uses brute force. So that's the, if we want to get down to what the wicked person is, that's how he defined it. And the righteous, again, is the person who accepts reality. He starts with what's true out there and tries to align himself with it. And he sees that it follows a path of reason. And the more he's in line with that reasonable lifestyle, the less conflicts he has with everything that's in the Torah. There's no issues about him keeping commands, because now he recognizes the good. He recognizes God's role. He's not trying to force his own agenda onto reality in the universe. He's the opposite. So that is an attitude, really, a trait which is even prior to compliance with the Torah. So he's really one step before the sinner. The sinner is then the person who would then go against the will, God's will of his outline in the Torah. But even without Torah, you can have a wicked person. Two guys are talking. One guy doesn't like the other guy said. He can't reason with him, so he lifts his hand. So that very attitude, that mindset, that says this is now how reality is run by force, so that's wicked.
The one's almost more about the philosophy and one's more about the action.
Yeah, I mean, I think the safest thing is to say that the sinner is the one that then, again, chet means against God's will, commands. That's what a sin is. It could be worse. I'm not sure which is worse. It would seem to be intuitively that the sinner is worse, because now he's going against God, not just a friend.
I'm not sure I follow that part about going against God versus a friend.
Because when you're arguing, when Dustin and Aviram were arguing, and one lifts his hand to the other, so it wasn't necessarily, there's nothing wrong with arguing with somebody. And there wasn't any really laws at that time governing what they were involved in, whatever that discussion was. So he lifted his hand because he wasn't winning the argument. And he was about to hit the other guy. So that's not a violation of any of the laws that they had. So it's not a sin. But it shows wickedness because his worldview is that I have to be correct. And if there's no other way to prove I'm right, then, hitting the other guy is going to prove it. You see this in conversations, even in discussions with people that they get very intolerant, they yell and they raise their voice, and and then they feel that, and then, I mean, that's okay. I mean, in terms of getting passionate about study and discussions, that's fine. That's part of it. Actually, Rabbi Chaya explained this. He said this, the word, there's no politics, when you're learning. I mean, your sole focus has to be what you're discussing, the concepts. And you can't have any other considerations. Oh, I have to be politically correct in my activities, the way I speak right now. All these restraints are now tapping the energy that you really should be putting into just a pure search for the knowledge. So you have to allow 100% of your energies to go in to the debate and discuss, and therefore raising your voice and this and that is all fine. There's nothing wrong. This is part of the whole, discourse of study. So that's an important thing. But when conversations or debates turn, and I've seen this happen, to personal accusations, because they can't win the argument, then they start taking pot shots at the personality. Then you see already that's basically the same philosophy as lifting your hand. Now you're taking personal attacks on the person, character assassination. Because since the person can't win his argument based on the facts, he says, oh, you know, where did you study, and this and that. Somebody was telling me this week, and it happened again. You know, they had no real arguments, but they just were uncomfortable with certain views because it went against their own, so they started, you know, attacking the individual. So that's wrong, even though it's, I mean, pre-Torah, you know, when they you said the Noahide laws at that point. But the corruption there, I don't necessarily call it, you know, a sin. Although Ze'iri comes in and says, no, it is a sin. So now we'll have to understand how Ze'iri can construe that event, where, you know, with Dustin and Aviram, how does he construe that as a sin? I mean, there was no Torah at that point.
I'm sorry,
the question is, so we understand the first view in Reish Lakish. He says this is a wicked person. There's no real, you know, violation of Torah here, or the Noahide laws that they had. He's called wicked because his lifestyle is against reality. He's wicked. He's going against you know, the way a person should work, you know, in reality. Force and raising your hand is not in line with truth. It's not in line with the reality. So you're wicked. You're going against reality. But Ze'iri says the same person is a sinner. So how is he a sinner if there's no law that is violating? Okay?
Does the term sinner have to operate only in a halakhic context?
I would think so. I mean, listen, I may be wrong. I can't say 100%. You know, unless I could see every single time that the word is used. That's not going to happen.
So if there's no law...
Yes, and then why is this person called a sinner? Why is Dustin or Aviram, who was lifting his hand, why is it called a sinner? According to Ze'iri.
Well, but wait a second. I mean, the first part says, Reish Lakish says, if one raises his hand against his fellow. So how did we deduce that there's no law in effect in Reish Lakish's situation?
Well, what laws did they have? Is this part of the Noahide laws? You can't hit somebody?
Oh, I see. You're in the context of the Noahide laws. Okay.
Yeah. It was pre-Sinai.
Yeah. Let's call this sinner. What prevents you from hitting somebody? That's an interesting aside. Even today, for a Noahide, if I get mad at somebody and I haul up and smack them, did I violate one of the seven Noahide laws?
Right. Well, according to Ze'iri, you have, it seems to be. I mean, we never took it to that end yet because we're still relatively at the beginning of studying, you know, the Noahide laws here.
Except that, Rabbi, he uses as his source text, you know, a verse about the children of Eli, and that was post-Sinai.
Right, but he still is arguing on the very case that was brought up. Ze'iri's saying, no, the person like this, right, he doesn't give a whole new case. Right, he just says the person who raises his hand is called wicked. And then Ze'iri comes in and says he's called a sinner. Nikra. I mean, who's called the sinner? It must be the same person that they were just talking about. That's why he's coming in and commenting on it.
Yep.
I mean, that's what I learned. I just, you know, I think that's the simplest way. In the JHS on screen, there's just he's saying that he's making his law by himself. So maybe that's addressing why it's called a sinner. But I think we can say that it coincides the Erie who calls him a sinner, is that if a person, if a Ben Noach, or a person recognizes something as being against God's will, even without having a, you know, verbally communicated law, that would be, you know, a sin. If a person understands something as being God's will, and he violates that, so that's what we would call sin. For example, you know, the Gemara's that talk earlier, there's one view that said that Ben Noach is, he's chayev, he's got to keep even all the whole area of magic, which we actually read yesterday, Shoftim, where it talks about the sorcerers and the witchcraft and all that. So even though that's not listed as one of the seven Noahide laws, so that was a view in the Gemara that says even those would be a violation. Right? And that's something which you could figure out intelligently would be, you know, those things are just no power whatsoever. There's nothing to them. So perhaps sin here means when you know that it's going against God's will for man.
Well, but that seems like it would open up a whole potential can of worms. For example, it's the will of Hashem that the Jewish people keep kosher.
Right.
Okay. But if a Noahide doesn't, can we say, well, he's going against the will of Hashem?
No, because there's two types of laws. There are laws that are what we would call sensible laws or intelligent laws that you would derive even without God telling you. But then there's laws which are, you know, called the chukim, the statutes. And those include things that you would never come up with on your own had God not communicated it in the Torah as a command. For example, wearing black boxes on our head and our arms. Wearing strings in a certain format on our garments. Kosher. All right, the scapegoat, the red heifer, all these different laws are called chukim, because we wouldn't come up. Now, there's beautiful ideas in them all, but they're not something which they call a mitzvah sichlius. It's a mitzvah that you would arrive at through your own subjective intelligence. So no, Noah would not be sinning over here by eating something like, you know, crab. Because it's just not something he would ever come up with. You can't blame the person if it's outside of his radar. But in terms of forcibly taking something or threatening, so now you're going against, you know, this property. And I guess maybe because it's tied to stealing, which is a Noahide law, so therefore it's considered sin. Because it's already approaching that, even though the sons of Eli were entitled, but the manner in which they did it was sinful.
So could it be then that raising your hand against your fellow to strike him would come under the prohibition against the murder because you are in a situation where you could potentially kill the person?
I don't think so. I mean, murder is pretty clear what that is. All right, but let's hold on to those two. I mean, it's an interesting thing, but again, I think that the one really nice point so far is that wicked person is the one who, even though he didn't hit yet, but since he was moved physically, he has to go to that point. He can't, even if he's frustrated inside and he doesn't lift his hand, then he's not called wicked yet. It's only once it translates to reality that now that demonstrates. So we didn't say this yet, but he's not wicked until he moves his hand, until he lifts his hand. Of course, he doesn't have to hit the person. That's exactly what the Talmud said. But he has to make some motion. That means to say that he crossed the line of internal feelings to practice. to how he lives. So the wicked person is the one that crossed the line. I mean, the righteous person doesn't even get to that point. He's not affected by that. He uses intelligent arguments. He sees somebody doesn't listen, so that's it. His goal in life is not to be right and to push his views on other people. He'll talk clearly. He'll talk with passion, and that's it. Now the words have to do their work. There's nothing more he wants to do because he understands that the life is really where you perceive the truth, and then that's what really moves you. So it goes against this whole philosophy to try to get a person to act based on brute force. So a righteous person will say his, speak his mind, and that's it. But the wicked person is the one that can't tolerate that, and it bothers him that the other person's not listening to him. Meaning, in my subjective view of the world, I've got to be right, and you're not agreeing with me? I can't take that. Now I've got to do something physically to change that. So if I frighten you, even if I know you're just going to say it just because you don't want to get hit, that to me would be sufficient because, I'd be a fool in that case. I want to be right. I want you to admit, I want you to be subservient to me. So even your admission, and I would know clearly, very well that you're just saying it to escape any type of a harm, that to me is going to satisfy me as a wicked person. But I have to cross the line between my feelings and moving into action. Some action has to take place. That means that I'm now entering the lifestyle where as soon as I lift my hand, even if I put it back down again, but if I lift my hand, that now demonstrates that I felt, I have a philosophy that translated into physical action just now. That's corruption. That's a wicked person. And we're not talking about where a person has alarmed. I remember Rabbi Chaim was discussed with a rabbi. He had all his notes on his table, and he had a cup of tea, and he was writing his notes, all his notes there. And somebody sat down, knocked the table, and the tea spilled over, and all the notes. And the rabbi stood up quickly, but then he sat down. So the standing up quickly was just an emotional, it caught him, because this is all these hours and weeks of notes that he's been writing, now completely destroyed in a split second. So he was caught, but then he realized, no. So that is nothing you can do about it, and that was it. So even righteous person is going to have his moments. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu, and down the ladder, everybody. But we're talking about here where a person does this. And if he does it regularly, you see that Rav Huna had his hand cut off. And that's what we're going to have to get to now. The difference between Rav Huna's point that you cut off the hand, or is it just, a monetary value that you fine the person? Or is it the last we think, Rabbi Elazar, who says, no, there's no remedy except for the grave? So that's the other side now, in terms of how do you respond to somebody like this? But the first discussion was really in terms of understanding, what the nature of wickedness is and sinning. But so we just come away from the first discussion. Wickedness is where the person's intolerance was translated into action. If you didn't cross that line, then you're not wicked. That means you may have feelings, but you're not saying that I have to live my life this way. So the practical application of your philosophy, if you didn't apply it, that means you hold from the Torah. You're going to hold yourself back from lifting your hand because you recognize that what I have to do practically is God's system. Of course, it's not the best level to have reached the point where you have to control yourself. But that's a level. If a person can control himself, that's a level. He's showing restraint. Of course, the best level is where he sees clearly in his mind that there's nothing here to get upset about. The person doesn't agree with me, fine. Okay?
Okay.
All right, so now let's take Rav Huna and Rabbi Elazar. So Rav Huna says you got to cut off the arm. Let's just leave that loose, whether or not it means monetary fine or literally doing it. Or Rabbi Eliezer says that there's no remedy except for the grave. Okay, so let's see if we can understand what they're saying in terms of how you respond to a person who always is using his arms against people.
Is there a sense in here that this is habitual? Because in Rav Huna's case, it almost sounds like if you did it once, your hand should be cut off.
No, he did it regularly. That's not true. There it said that he did this, this was his practice.
And where do we find that?
Yeah, what's that?
Where do we find the part about it's his regular practice?
Yeah, it's Rashi. Rashi says, the leading words of Rashi is, he cut his hand, Kates Yoda. So he said he cut the hand from a man, from one man, that was accustomed to hit his friends. So they fined him with this response. Right. And he says that Beis Din is allowed, the courts are allowed to hit and punish, even though it's not from the Torah, but they could do it as a offense to the Torah. So I guess it means that even though what he was doing was not from not a D'oraisa violation, it was not a Torah violation, but a rabbinic one. So, and that's Rav Huna, but Rabbi Eliezer says, a guy who's always waving his hand, right? It's fitting to kill him and to bury him. So that's what it says. I mean, it's not only that there's no remedy but the grave, but the saying that you can actually kill the person. Meaning the cutting of the hand is not sufficient. Right? So you have two views. You have Rav Huna and you have Rabbi Eliezer. And again, they both base it on verses, because everything has to be, you know, based in the Torah. So one verse is that the hand of that are on high, that are lifted, should be broken. So that's where he gets the justification to lop off his hand or fine him. And then the other one is that the verse is a man of the hand, to him will be the land. If him will be the land means that you put him in the land.
Wow.
Yep. It says it's fitting. It doesn't say you do it. Rashi says that it's fitting to kill him and to bury him. He's worthy of death. So it's telling you a real severe crime that this guy is doing. But again, it's all going on the one case, a person who lifts his hand against his friend.
Well, and there's something else that troubles me too here. In Rav Huna's case, he's saying you cut the arm off. Well, we know that any violation of the seven Noahide laws is a capital offense. To the best of my knowledge, there is no other penalty for a violation of those laws.
Yeah, there's death for anyone.
Pardon?
Right?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The death is the punishment for any violation.
Right, there's no lashes, there's no sort of interim thing, so now Rav Huna's coming up with, oh, but you cut his hands off.
Well, therefore, you must say he didn't violate a Noahide law, then.
If he didn't violate a Noahide law, but we're calling him a sinner, right, and we have no other halakhic environment in place...
Well, there is one thing to pay attention to here now that we're talking about Noahide. In the case of Moses, so that was clearly a case that was pre-Torah. But now the Rav Huna is coming in, now they're talking about this very trait of the person. Let's apply it now. So you could say he's talking about the Torah system, that it's derived, it started, the whole conversation started with Moses, right? But now they're talking about, now what would be the response in terms of this now, in terms of the Torah system? So it seems to me they're talking now in terms of the Torah system. It's not Noahide anymore. I mean, the dispute between Rav Huna and Rabbi Eliezer is now a dispute in terms of the system of 613, the Torah system, the full-blown Torah system. Originally, the Torah was, the Gemara here was just starting off with a philosophical discussion about, is the person wicked or is he a sinner? Right? So they start off from those cases, which one happened to be before the Torah was given, and one happened to be after the Torah was given. One was Moses and Dustin and Abiram, and the other one was the sons, the wicked sons of Eli. But now they're talking about what's the practical application in terms of punishment in the Torah system. So it seems to be now it's talking about the Torah system. All right? That's the way I'm reading it.
Okay.
So that being the case, the whole issue about the Noachid is out, but now there still is a philosophical idea we can learn from this in terms of perfection, so we can discuss this. So, is it a cutting of the hand, or is it the person deserves death?
Well, I guess one of the things that bothers me about Rabbi Elazar's point is, what about repentance?
Yeah, there's always repentance. The person who murders can repent, you know.
So when Rabbi Elazar says he has no remedy other than burial,
yeah,
is he the sinner?
The sinner, he's talking about the person who's doing this. I think repentance has to be taken out of the equation right now.
Okay. So when he says he has no remedy, who's the he?
Right, yeah, I mean the guy. You mean to say that when he says no remedy, you mean there's no repentance wouldn't work?
Well, right. I don't understand, I guess, the concept of the term remedy then and what he's talking about.
Yeah, let's see what he says. Let me read it again. There's no takana. Let's see if Rashi says anything on that. I would say that it's talking about if he doesn't repent. I want to assume the least over here. But that they're trying to give you some insight into this type of a personality that is forceful on other people. But the person doesn't raise his hand against an inanimate object or an animal. He's always raising his hand against the person.
Okay.
So why is death, why is the ground befitting for this person?
Well, I mean, you've got someone in your society who is not seeing reality. Okay, so that's a concern right there. But as a result of not seeing that reality, they are taking action that is destructive to the society. I mean, the guy's going around beating other people up. And you can't have a society that will last eventually when you've got forces in it that are sort of destroying it from within, unless you find some way to check those forces.
Yeah, he would even say, too, that cutting the hand is not sufficient, right? You'd have to say that about Rabbi Elazar's view.
Yeah, and he might argue that the only remedy is burial because, I mean, let's suppose that you cut the guy's hand off. Well, okay, he's got another one.
So you cut that one off. So then, what do you do? He still would say you have to kill him.
I'm sorry. Say again.
Even if you cut both of his hands off, he would still have to be killed, according to Rabbi Elazar.
Right, because now he's, you know, he can go kick somebody. I mean,
yeah, but the he's saying that the yeah, it's an interesting thing. That why is it that he has to be killed? Well, what is his real crime? What is this guy's real crime? He doesn't say that a robber has to be taking the land. He says he quotes a verse. Evidently, he says the Torah has a verse that addresses this very specific phenomenon because it's really significant. right? The man of the hand, to him will be the ground. To him will be the earth. Meaning, you got to bury that guy. Doesn't say that by a man of money or a man of sexual activity. No, it's a man of the hand, a guy who uses force against others. There's something we have to, you know, pinpoint over here that we don't have yet. We're missing what it exists in this personality and no other personality that demands that he be laid in the grave.
Okay. Then maybe this then comes back to the whole main subject area of what you identified for this morning, and that is that trait of human aggression. Because when you talk about a thief or you talk about somebody that's, you know, committing sins of a sexual nature, you're not talking about human aggression. A thief, he's got his reasons. The person, you know, doing sexual-related sins has their reasons. But it's not about aggression, which is a force that is focused on having power over others. And it's that force that I'm going to suggest Rabbi Elazar is saying we've got to bury, because it is ultimately destructive to the society.
Good. Well, stealing is also. Stealing is also destructive to society, you know. I would say that you might say that rape would fall into this category too, because the person is using their body forcibly against somebody else.
Right. So maybe it gets to, you're right. I mean, theft will destroy society, and so will, you know, unbridled.
But that's a known thing. We know that rape and that killing is something which you have to get rid of the person. The real new point, the new insight here, is that even if you just raise your hand against people, you deserve the death, you know, the death penalty. That's the thing we have to try to understand. What's the even? Even this, you can, the guy deserves death.
And I wonder if it's because, if I contrast that with a thief. Okay, so the thief is caught, he has to pay back, or he's sold into slavery, or whatever it might be. Okay, and he has an opportunity there to, you know, reflect on why he did what he did, and perhaps he'll repent, perhaps he won't. But the person that's driven by aggression, I'm wondering if they're getting at that is not something that just by virtue of a punishment, like we'll put you in jail for 10 days, is going to solve the problem that the individual has. In other words, the aggression is still there. It's still going to come out. It's a force. And with that, anything short of destroying the person means that force is going to still be within the society and will continue to be exercised and cause people harm.
Right. So the only remedy, is this guy should be removed from the picture. I mean, he feels that he is right, and this, you know, this is how he's going to get his way. And force I was wondering if the fact that he's about to be killed for his crime, and now it's a corrective thing. He now realizes that he is not dictating reality, and that his very existence is not as he views it. I mean, the guy who uses force is of the opinion that my view trumps everybody else. So really, death is the opposite to that, which is, I mean, it's just trying to understand better why death should be appropriate to really put him in his place. If that's really your view, then you have to recognize, it's like, for example, a person who speaks Lashon Hara, evil speech. So what's the remedy? He's made into a leprous person, contagious. He has to be outside the camp, and Why? Because his whole lifestyle was putting down other people. Again, it's very similar to a guy that hits other people. But here it was character assassination. That's what the person who speaks Lashon Hara is all about. So he puts down people with his mouth. So now it's a way of elevating the self. So what do? We show that it's just the opposite. You're nothing. Nobody can talk to you. You're outside the camp. You're nothing. So it's sort of like death. So here also the person who is of the opinion, I mean, the fact that he raises his hand is really just an expression of the real corruption. And the real corruption is that his view is that everything is by him. He can't tolerate being wrong, and he's got to have his way in life. So death is really a response to that. That he's removed from the picture. You're going to have no role now. I mean, if you think you have to exert your subjective feelings onto how your experience on Earth operates, so then this type of lifestyle is worthless. And you have to be removed from it. The removing of it shows that whole outlook is completely intolerant to the world's existence. It's like you're saying, I'm just trying to pinpoint why in this specific crime there's no remedy except to be laid in the ground. Because that really equalizes his wrong view. And JHS on screen is writing, is the only remedy not the Torah? I'm assuming that's a question. Yes, but this is the Torah's view here. This is the Torah's view. What Rabbi Elazar is expressing. According to Rav Huna, he says you could do the minimal necessary. You remove the object of the crime, which is the hand. You find him, or you actually lop off his hand. A guy like that, it seems to be literal. That's what Rashi was saying. There was a guy, he used to constantly be using his fists and his hands, so they cut it off. I mean, they just removed. In terms of his own internal perfection, that he'll have to work on. But it was a practical remedy. But Rabbi Elazar is talking about an internal remedy. Because, yes, practically, you can tie the guy's arms up too, and he's not going to be using his arms anymore. But you haven't addressed the real issue. The real issue is the person's view, that whatever I want has to be, and if I can't get it that way, I will use force. So that is really, it seems to be, it's an argument as to how do you address. Is it just a practical address of the problem? Or are we trying to take the person and imbue him, whatever few moments it is before he's killed, but he knows that even after he's dead why he's killed. I mean, his soul still survives that punishment, if he deserves, the next world.
Well, and is it that maybe this is just a different way of saying that you were talking about the opposite of a person's view, and the sort of death is the opposite of that. Rav Huna maybe is taking the point that, well, if he uses his arm to strike, the opposite of that is to take away his arm. So maybe it's a question of defining what is the appropriate opposite of a person who conducts that act.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, right. Like, what are we responding to? We're responding to just the physical objects, so then you remove it. We're responding to the internal workings, and here this person, the only remedy is that he's laid down. I mean, I'm wondering if what you said earlier is true as well, that this may be a case where the person, there is no other remedy, even tshuva. But the Rambam says nothing stands in front of tshuva. Nothing stands in front of tshuva. So it should apply to this guy too. All right, let's give it some thought. It's still... There may be more to it. You see, it is a phenomenon that the Torah went out of the way to have a verse, so that's something which we should be sensitive to. That if you see the Torah goes out of the way and has a verse that addresses this, that means it's significant. That's a real significant thing, that a person gets to the point that it lifts his hand. So that's a real, you know, other people in the, you know, in the world today will say, oh, what's the big deal? Everybody gets angry now and then, they lift the hand. No, but we're, you know, we're trying to follow the philosophy of perfection. And, you know, God wiped out the world by Noah because there was force was used. As the Rashi says that the only reason why the fate of the generation of the flood came was because of stealing. So, it is an interesting point, because why? Why is that worse than, were they, I mean, they were taking women by force? Well, it seems to me that's worse, unless you want to include that in stealing, or you want to say that the fate was sealed when they started stealing, because then that opened the floodgates for all the other emotions to run rampant. So because of that unbridled activity of stealing, that was it. Other things, of course, became maybe worse after that. But the real flaw over here is that the person has a subjective view of how he wants things. I'm right, I want this, this is mine. And when things get in his way, he can't learn that he's wrong. He just keeps on pushing his agenda forward. So someone like that, you could say there's another aspect why death is the only thing, because life is not he's not gaining from life. Life is, he's not learning where his errors are. He does not accept that he's making any mistakes. He justifies everything he does. So what's his life for? Just to, life is not to just push forward your own agenda and to do, that's a useless life, there's nothing to it. So it really, it goes counter, I mean, there's another point, it goes counter to the life of a person who's looking to learn and to accept new truths in his mind and live that way. But a person that uses force is just the opposite of a person that's seeking truth. There is no change. He has one agenda and it stays that way. So that this world is not for a person like that. All right, well, give us some thought. But I think this last point also deserves a little more thought. You know what I'm saying? You hear what I'm saying, this last point?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting nut to crack.
Right, but a guy like this won't want to crack the nut. He'll just want to find the nut that's open already.
Right.
He's not going to tolerate that reality. But it is interesting that you have a pasuk, you have a verse. That's significant. That's a very significant thing. And you have it a number of times too, by Moses, by Eli, and then in terms of the response, you have two more verses. There's four verses that deal with this. But that's where we start. We start from, you know, children, and keep, you know, you see kids today. Mine. You know, the kid is the center. So the self is a very, very, very powerful source. And to really move away from that, you see many people that just don't. Even in Torah. I mean, and if I mentioned to you once, I was once at a lecture, and, I think the guy was a rabbi, and he just cannot, you know, accept being wrong. And he even looked at himself as being greater than Rashi. He said, you know, who can see further, the giant or the midget that's sitting on the shoulders of the giant? He was approached and asked, "Are you saying that you're better than Rashi?"
And he couldn't say no. And he became very violent. And he stormed out after there was a confrontation with him and someone there. And the person was, you know, quoting some other verses. And he was like questioning, you know, the rabbi was like questioning, oh, you think you know that book so well? It was amazing that the person actually had such an ego that that was really a real expression of this, you know, this type of a thing. The same emotion. The me emotion. And we're lucky if, you know, we see that we get to the point where we really, you know, from our teachers that we can really start appreciating knowledge and you know, accept that, you know, our, you know, we become humble students of Torah, and then that's really something to be happy about. That, you know, there's nothing else that we're looking for except to really understand truth and to accept when we're wrong, and you know that, you know, the ego is just not, plays no role. So, you know, to reach that point, that's a very that's a very important thing. That's what it says, that the beginning of knowledge is the fear of God. If that person has no fear, he thinks he's got all the answers, so that's it. You know, you can't make an impression on a person like that. That has to be broken. This is important when we raise kids, that's something that they learn. And, you know, luckily kids have an inborn respect for authority. So teaching them from their youth is very important. If they don't learn from youth, then their egos develop. So, we mentioned last week that that's why King David's son, Adoniyahu, was able to rebel, because he was never rebuked from his youth. So he was. It says in one verse that he was very handsome, and that he never was rebuked by David, and that he took over the kingdom. So it was because he was handsome that David didn't want to upset him and, you know, take that beautiful smile off his face. That since he learned, he never learned any type of disappointment. So he never had the fear of authority. So it's very important that, you know, that natural fear of authority that the kids and the children have today, they learn about it and then they apply it to the rabbis, and they learn to respect the great wisdom that the rabbis have, and then they ultimately, you know, will transfer that onto their appreciation for God. And so this way, that natural born, that inborn humility and respect for authority is something which is sustained, and it's cultivated and refined and brought to really a system in the life of learning. As they get older and older, like, you know, it says by Moses, he was the most humble man that walked the face of the earth. Because with the greater wisdom came a greater awareness of the contrast between God and between man. So that gave him the greatest humility. So that you see that that's part of God's design. You know, you see that God designed Adam and Eve without parents. So he could have done that with the rest of the world. But evidently it was his design that there should be a growth process of, you know, a very small infant with parents, and then to finally go out on his own. Because that process of growth and having parents is very important in the development of, you know, our respect and humility and towards God and recognizing him as an authority. And we said this many times, that is why honoring parents is part of the first five of the Ten Commandments. Those first five address laws between man and God. So you think that honoring parents shouldn't be there. No, but we understand it's there as a role model for how we are eventually going to be honoring and respecting God. It has to start from youth, though. But if you don't have it from youth, then if you don't have that imbued, so then the ego is going to take over. And it could be that there may be a point where there's no return. Maybe that's also another point to the Gemara, that there is no remedy. It could be that the ego is such a strong element in man that once he has that feeling of satisfaction, like the case of this rabbi that I was telling you, that just could not accept, you know, a critique, and he had to look at himself as greater than Rashi. I mean, I'm still amazed. This is going back 15 years, but I remember that incident very clearly, and just amazed how that type of an arrogance, that type of ego can be so brazen and transparent at the same time. But the person himself didn't see it. Okay, so let's wrap it up for today here. I guess it's the next week. You look over in Talmud Avodah Zarah.
and it starts about towards the end of the first page, that's 2a, where God says, let all those who have involved themselves in Torah come and receive the reward. So there are all the nations of the world were clamoring to come and get it, and there's a whole dialogue. And again, the dialogue didn't take place, but it's what the rabbis wrote in order to teach us ideas, and there's ideas there at every turn. And you go to about 3a, 3b, go through it a few times, because there's a lot there. Alright?
Alright, sounds good.
Alright, so we'll do that next week.
Alright, thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate this a lot.
Okay, my pleasure.
You have a great week.
You too, everybody. Have a great week. Enjoy.
Okay.
Alright.
Bye-bye.
Take care.